CliffCentral.com.
France Crenier is with the Institute of Race Relations. They do amazing work in South Africa. They provoke a lot of really interesting conversations. They have a group of people involved with them who are by no means afraid to voice their opinions, to investigate interesting issues, and to compile some very, very useful statistical data about where we're at as a country. I've given a very broad and ugly synopsis of what you guys do. It's obviously a lot more complicated than that, and in some ways a lot more interesting, I'm sure, too. But, France, it's a pleasure to have you here, and thank you for joining us. It's good that we have an Institute of Race Relations, that we have someone outside of government. We have a group of people who are dedicated to studying this kind of thing, because society these days is a very complicated place. If we followed what social media tells us society is, we'd be confused, and we'd probably often be wrong.
Yeah.
If we followed what the government tells us about how society is, we would also get a very skewed picture of where we're at. Hopefully you guys bring some sense to all of that nonsense. You do the studies, you speak to the people in the know. A lot of the hard work that nobody else is prepared to do before they have an opinion.
Yeah, but what we do is quite simple. You say it's complex, but it's not really. What we do is two things, essentially. We're a think tank, largely privately funded. We don't have terribly many major donors. We market our reports to people who want to read them. And the essentially two functions. The one is to try and find out what's going on in the country, the facts that sit behind trends, and to present those in a way that I can understand them and normal people can understand them, and to push that into the public domain as far and as broad as we possibly can. And when we do that, very often what we find is what you said, that, for example, the social media world that's presented is a planet very far away from the reality and experience of ordinary South Africans. So that's our one function. And we try and advise people who make decisions on South Africa about what's actually happening in the country. The second thing that we do is perhaps even more important, and that is to engage in the battle of ideas. And this is something we can talk about a bit. We think that ideas are the most powerful influence on any society. The policies of a particular government at any point in time is simply a reflection of the dominant idea in that society. And it's pointless to pursue a change a particular policy if the dominant set of ideas that gave rise to that policy in the first place remain in place. And the example we often cite is that of some of the Institute's work in the apartheid era, when it mm-hmm. would have been pointless on its own, for example, to oppose the Group Areas Act.
Yeah.
As long as the broader principle of that we must all live separately from each other remained intact. Once that broader idea had been eroded, the policies that flew out of it
also disappear like mist before the sun. Yeah.
And in our Battle of Ideas work today, we take a very different line to many commentators, many other analysts, a lot of the state, a lot of the experts, where the view is held that the state should direct people's lives and activities and regulate what they do and think and how they run businesses. We think that people are far better off left to their own devices as far as possible.
So,
we're not dogmatic.
So you're not statists.
We're not statists.
If you were ideological, and I'll ask you about your own predilections just now, but hopefully, you know, that they'd be kept to a minimum, because in exploring ideas and the battleground of ideas, you give all of them an equal chance at the beginning, and then you measure them on their result.
Yeah, we're not dogmatic. We have deep ideological roots, and people are scared of ideology, and I don't think they should be. I think it's important to have ideological roots, because that means that you react to issues in a consistent manner. There's a reason why you take a particular position.
But there are good and bad ideologies.
They're good and bad, and that's the battle of ideas. It's the
right.
battle between
but
the
But sometimes
ideas.
Bad ideas are propped up by states, for example, or by religions, or by NGOs that have a particular bent.
That is the battle of the battle of ideas. And it's the most important battle of all to sit in.
It's difficult to have that battle, though, if the state is holding up their ideology. And an ordinary citizen, without the powers of the state, has to fight almost like a David and Goliath battle against them with their horrible ideas.
It's incredibly difficult. And the frustration we have is very often a group, perhaps a business or so, will approach us and say to us, this specific policy of the state is one, it's completely counterproductive, and will you help us to explain that?
Yeah.
And we'll say, certainly, we can help to explain that, but far more useful would be to go back behind that policy and explain the ideological underpinnings that gave rise to it in the first time. And at that point, the client in question starts to back away and says, no, we don't want to get involved in ideological battles. But if you're not going to confront that battle, then you're just going to go around in circles in terms of your own of your own policy advocacy and lobbying. You need to be, if you don't get involved in ideology and the politics that's sustained by the ideology, that ideology is going to get involved with you.
Yes, correct.
And and very often
you don't do anyone any favors by hiding your head in the sand when ideology is busy waging war against other ideologies.
Yes. And you need to engage. And I think business, use them as an example. One of the great failures of business advocacy in South Africa is often the inability to understand that there are underpinning ideologies. And when it is understood,
the lack of courage
to confront those ideologies and say that there are better sets of ideas, better ways to do things.
Well, I'm sorry, this is going to be the most boring interview then, because we agree.
Yeah, but you're a rare thing, and you're a very rare platform for us, because there are not many media spaces left where it's easy to put this argument out on its own, as innocent as it seems. Very often, we confront what's looking more and more like a pretty closed media monopoly in South Africa. How many big media houses control radio, TV, and print publications? You can't about
six. We've broken it down before. I mean, you've got ANN7 and the New Age, which are Gupta controlled. You've got Avusa Times Media Limited, which look like they're going to buy Prime Media. That would be, you know, another big consortium conglomerate, and we know how much influence the government have in that place and the trade unions. There's supposedly independent media, which is Iqbal Serv, and his cronies, and they're all cronies of, again, political influence. Who have you got besides that? You've got ENCA, which has been compromised. I mean, they've got, you know, Marcel Golding left eventually under a cloud because of politics. So really, what...
And in radio, you've got the SABC, which is
I left them out because I don't think...
In the media space.
I don't think anyone with a brain considers them to be credible anymore.
But they reach millions of people.
Absolutely.
And in that battle of ideas work that we do, smaller independent operations like yours here, I think are worth their weight in gold to the country. I don't think people appreciate just how important they are. The small media entrepreneurs who set up their news websites and are brave enough to put an alternative view across. You've got a show attached to you here, The Renegade Report, which does that very bravely. And the irony is there's a great demand for that. When we go out and talk to people, talk to audiences, and we break through that stifling political correctness, that you dare not challenge a dominant ideology, the relief you see in the audience, the appreciation for it is enormous.
Let me
ask
you something.
Irony, it's very difficult to find that in the media market.
The Institute of Race Relations, you're the CEO. You guys encounter a lot of different audiences in different places. Sometimes it's academic, sometimes it's from government, outside of government, other think tanks, businesses. Do you think South Africans are stupid? Do you think that part of the reason that the limited media options available in this country, do you think that part of the problem there is that ordinary South Africans don't question things, that they're happy to accept the explanation of government?
No, not at all. Quite the opposite is true. I'll give you this number. Of all South Africans over the age of 18, so people who'd be entitled to vote, 42% no longer vote. And in 1994, that number was 14%. And we experience procession through every year of Swedish-funded development experts who come to South Africa and come and see us and say, we must do something to teach these people that they need to vote. It's important to vote. In our analysis, the 42% that don't vote are the politically astute. They're the best informed. They're the young people who are looking around at the country and saying, actually, I look at you, the ANC, and I don't think you're going to make my life better in the next 18 months. And I look at the DA, and I see less and less of a distinction between you and the African National Congress. And Mr. Malema gets less than 10% of the vote in a country where 50% of people aged 20 to 30 are not in education, employment, or training. Because they don't go for his nonsense. The ordinary guy in the middle ground, middle South Africa, is incredibly well informed, politically astute, and very, very sensible. And a lot of the reason that our country is as resilient as it is, it's got this hostile government, these hostile policies, these hopeless politicians across the spectrum. And yet we make it day by day by day. It's the commitment and resilience of ordinary South Africans to make it work. And in the last couple of years, we've been fortunate in that we've been given the money to do a lot of nationally representative opinion polling.
Mm-hmm.
And the results of late last year's polling I actually reviewed yesterday. And we ask questions such as, should the national rugby team be selected according to quotas or according to merit? And if you listen to the clown of sports minister, you'll believe that should it not be quota-based, the race war will break out tomorrow. And
yeah,
the rugby union falls over itself, groveling before the minister. And
yeah,
and to grovel before him is particularly
onerous and nasty, yeah.
And you know, 75% of South Africans say no, that it shouldn't be quota-selected. It should be merit-selected. There was a piece in the Times newspaper recently about the race war and if it played itself out, what would the race war be like? And it goes as far as to talk about European mercenaries coming to South Africa to kill blacks. It's completely nuts. The polling of late last year shows us that 85% of South Africans agree with the statement that across lines of race, we need each other to work together if we're going to be successful as a country. And that's such a good example.
So why am I hearing so much nonsense from the left? Why do I hear all this crap about how Mandela was a sellout? How do I hear that there is no rainbow nation? Why do I keep hearing people who are stoking the fires of hatred, of division, of us and them? Where is this coming from?
There's a vast amount of fabricated information.
Fake news.
Fake news and fabricated news that enters the public domain. And I'll answer your question, but let's set some of the context of it. The idea is created. Mandela sold out. Nothing got better in South Africa. We were better off under Pierre Verwoerd and his Rubicon speech of 1985. In material terms, it's absolute nonsense. There's a report coming out from us this month on the extent of transformation in the broader sense in the country in the last 20 or 30 years. You know, the number of people with a job in South Africa has doubled. So trade unions, since 94, trade unions' comments about jobless growth are nonsense. For every shack built after 1994, 10 formal houses were built in the country. Service delivery is shockingly bad, and that's true. But it's also true that the extent of service delivery was good enough that it has vastly raised the living standards floor of ordinary people in the country. We've seen we measure living standards according to 10 categories, where if your living standards are in category 1, you're basically destitute, and if you're in 10, you're getting into the middle classes. The last 20 years has seen an exodus out of the lower 40% of living standard categories into the higher categories. And yet this view is presented that nothing got better, that things in fact got worse. There's jobless growth and no benefit in people's basic standards of living. We see in our polling that race relations are sound. We say the fabric is sound, but the edges are fraying. And yet you cannot but open a South African newspaper and read about the catastrophe that race relations are.
And no, there's always some pariah white person complaining about the beaches at New Year.
There's that. Why are those two views pushed so strongly? Nothing got better. Racism's the problem. We think that racism and the white privilege type of argument is the new word for socialism and essentially communism. You'd be discredited if you ran around in South Africa today and said we want to copy exactly what Hugo Chavez did in Venezuela or what Soviets did
for a while.
But really did for a while.
I think then it's become demonstrably false that that's the way you go.
Even on parts of the moderate left, if you said we want to replicate what happened in East Germany, that's the model. We want the state to take over the economy. If you said it directly, but if you start the story that nothing got better, and it didn't get better because of racism, and the racism is threatening the country, and the basis of the racism is the refusal to share wealth, the only conclusion left to draw is that a responsible state now needs to intervene more harshly in the country and the economy, to regulate more closely what people think and do, with all such terrible racists, and intervene more directly in directing economic activity. The basis of every draconian socialist society, you regulate what people think, and you regulate what they do in their businesses.
Totalitarian.
I think, behind the scenes, and of course my critics who hear this view say that, point to who it is, who's the conspiracy. And I'm not suggesting that's the case at all, of course not. I don't think that a group of people got together and planned this and this is some grand strategy that's being executed. I think it's far more dangerous than that, because if it was that, you could pin it down and you could deal with it.
And
I think it has, it is more organic. I think it is developing a life of its own, and that independent commentators and opinion formers are doing something very dangerous and very reckless in pushing these ideas that racism is the basis of economic exclusion in South Africa today, and that the state therefore needs to intervene and play a greater role in the country. It is the very front of the battle of ideas.
Right. So are you saying that these people have capitulated in order to be popular? Are you saying that these independent commentators, well, supposedly independent commentators, who are now driving an ideological agenda, are not, they're not rigorous enough in questioning the fundamentals of their own ideology and the ideologies of those politicians who seem to be profiteering, or at very least surviving on the basis of these racists, these white privilege groups, all of these things which they've, these ghosts they've created in order to have an enemy?
I think they're wrong, the left. I think they're wrong on the facts, and I think they push a destructive and evil ideology. And I think will do a lot of harm to our country. But I don't begrudge them the skill and resources they've been able to accumulate in order to do that. The blame does not lie with them, that the national debate has become so skewed. The blame lies with the other side of the equation, with the inability of the private sector, of people who believe in a capitalist future, who believe in absolute freedom of
some
of
kind of libertarianism, some sort of non-state.
The blame lies with that side of the equation, who are not committed to get into this fight and commit the financial resources to fighting it, to the extent that happens on the other side of the divide.
Well,
and that's the problem, because otherwise what I have to say is that the resources and so on that the left have developed, and financially the irony is that the left's financial resources to fight the battle of ideas in South Africa vastly exceed those of the of the relative sensible middle road that
these evil capitalists are as powerful as the left say they are, how come they can't commandeer these resources to the extent that the
left
can?
That's the great question.
Can I point out, just before we move on, I feel very strongly about this, because for example, when I got embroiled in someone else's fight in January of last year, and I was fired from Idols for making a comment about freedom of speech, precisely what you're talking about here, standing up to this leftist nonsense, although that was not my intention at the time, I decided I had to fight this, largely on the urging of a leftist, Dalim Pofu, who said, you've got to fight for yourself. And in the end, while we may be ideologically on opposite sides of the agenda here, he was right. I did decide to fight it. The problem is that clients and sponsors here on Cliff Central were afraid to have been associated with someone who's standing up for freedom of speech, not for the right or the left, freedom of speech, because it could have made them seem like they were not on the leftist side of the agenda. And this is how cowed, this is how weak and spineless private enterprise in this country has become, that they threatened to pull away from us completely, and in many cases did, in the case of certain big banks and so on, because they were so afraid. Just a few months later, those very banks were accused of the very thing I was accused of and found themselves unable to defend their own position.
Well, that's a great example of how the bank in question, banks in question, unable to understand the deeper ideological underpinnings of what's going on here. And why they get themselves in so much trouble. And the question you raise is the great one we raise in our office. Why is the world of capitalism and capitalism-driven free enterprise so inept at defending its own ideas? And it's not a South African problem, it's a global problem.
Yeah.
And the irony for you and your case, and sometimes the work we do, is that I could demonstrate to any partner of yours that your position, your views, were on the right side of public opinion, that the great majority of the country's people, if you polled them, would probably say, well, we like that guy's side of the story more than the other side. But it's that relative minority that's been able so effectively to capture the social media platforms and to capture the mainstream media.
That's debatable whether they have or haven't, but they've certainly created the perception that they've captured.
They've been able to capture, and perception's reality in politics.
And remember, so we've discovered since then that there's a paid Twitter. We've discovered since then that there are all kinds of cabals within Twitter that are, and I'm just talking about Twitter in this case because this is something I've paid careful attention to, that are fighting way above their weight in terms of actual support, in terms of actual public opinion being on their side. Very many of these people should not be more taken seriously than the guy on the side of the street trying to sell homeless talk.
We haven't pinned it down, and we've accepted in our own work and what we do that this environment will probably never change. One of my predecessors who ran the organization a very difficult time through the 80s and 90s said to me at the time when the Institute was a very prominent, it was probably the most influential anti-apartheid think tank anywhere in the world, it was extremely difficult to get support from the great and the good, with exceptions of Anglo-American and the Oppenheimers, who stood head and shoulders above much of the rest of the business community. And now, many decades later, we find ourselves in largely the same position. Much of the current business community that you might be able to draw lines back into our apartheid past have taken the same sycophantic type of groveling posture to the African National Congress, the inability to confront things that are actually wrong in our society, similar role to the one that they played under the apartheid government. We think that continues. And we don't think that's going to change. When I started doing what I do, which was almost 15 years ago, I was naive and thought, we'll change this, we'll point this out and we'll be successful. And I failed in every respect almost in doing that. And I think one of the things our side of the battle of ideas, talking for the Institute, I cannot of course speak for you, have accepted, is that we're going to have to fight this battle with far fewer resources than are going to be made available to the other side of the debate. But we've got one great asset on our side, and that is to come back to the same point. It's never emphasized enough in South Africa. It's the sense and goodwill of the great majority of the country's people. And when it comes to the defeat of oppressive regimes, and we don't live under an oppressive regime like the East Germans, but you know, we may get there one day.
There are, of course, lunatics.
Lunatics that would like to take us there, but we're largely.
And I was going to say there are people who fallaciously believe that that's where we are.
When you defeat oppressive regimes, as we defeated the apartheid regime and the East Germans and Soviets and whatever defeated their own regimes, what underpinned that defeat more than anything else wasn't always, very few cases, some outside force, experts, political leaders or so on came on and saved them. It was that same pragmatic central goodwill of ordinary people to, despite their leaders and their ideas, actually continue to make progress in their societies. And we have incredible confidence in that. We think there's a great well of goodwill, despite our weak economic performance and inequalities.
Can we no longer rely on? Because I don't understand one thing. I mean, in academic circles alone, let's say, there are professors, smart people. These are educated, learned people who teach other young people. I've met some of these people who are very proud of the fact they put it on their CVs that they're Marxists. Now, how can you be a sensible, rational adult and claim that your overriding political ideology of choice is Marxism when it is so soundly, roundly, and obviously, demonstrably been defeated in almost every instance where it's been applied? How can these people say that and still be given the responsibility of educating young people?
Well, there's a great hypocrisy in much of South Africa's
political life. I mean, that would be like me saying, I'm trying to find a metaphor for this. It would be like me saying I'm a flat earther and I would like to teach geography.
Yes. Well, there's a hypocrisy that sits in within the leadership or the most influential sides of lot of the political left around the world and in South Africa too. And that is that the foremost proponents of Marxist economics in South Africa are themselves wealthy people.
Mm.
The greatest critics of wealth inequality are often incredibly well paid. Mm. They live Western lives. The trappings of Western modernism are central to their own lives. They own property.
They're completely bourgeois.
They are completely bourgeois. And I think what distinguishes a lot of the left from the more pragmatic center of South Africa is that the left want for the poor a life different to what they as the leftist leaders themselves live. An example is land reform. We're not a banana republic, and we can be a modern industrial economy, not one in which people have to grovel around in the dirt chasing sheep about the Free State.
Mm.
But many prominent academics, most recently a politics professor at Wits University, suggested that massive land redistribution and reform, which implies the emergence of a small-scale peasant agricultural class, is absolutely essential to raise the living standards of black South Africans. It's offensively racist for a white academic at Wits University, who probably earns close to R1 million a year, to suggest that what blacks need
is to be rural peasants.
Is to be rural peasants chasing chickens on a plot of millies around the Karoo.
He gets away with it because he's a leftist.
Well, in this case, it was a woman. The difference.
She
was a leftist. They get away with it because of that.
And how sexist.
It's time and time again the case. We're very strong proponents of privatization in education, by which we mean that bureaucrats shouldn't decide how your children are educated. It's your money. It comes out of the fiscus. You as a community should own your school, take charge of it, decide on how the teachers are employed, what they earn, and what the rules of that school are going to be. That's what we call privatizing education. Advocacy groups on the political left oppose this incredibly strongly, even though the leaders of many of those groups send their children to schools where the same thing essentially applies.
So they're hypocrites.
It's one of the distinguishing fracture lines between the left and the pragmatic center in South Africa's battle of ideas is that I live a very comfortable middle class life in South Africa. I'm well paid in what I do. I live well.
Mm-hmm.
But what I want for relatively poor South Africans is the same as what I have, not something else. Not a lower. I choose where my children go to school.
But
Okay,
now you're in danger of, the minute you're not one of these wacky leftists, you're in danger of being called right. And we know what the right in South Africa looks like. They ran the place for a while. And we know what the right in South Africa is. And I don't think just by being opposed to the left, you are necessarily de facto right. This is a very small distinction that we must draw.
Look, if the slur right wing is thrown around, my colleagues disagree. I've got the point that you call me whatever you like.
Oh, you don't have.
But let me say what I stand for. But you get around that problem by, instead of drawing a straight line spectrum from left to right, imagine the spectrum as a horseshoe.
Yes.
The left and the right are the two little points of the horseshoe.
And they're close together.
And they're very close together. And the furthest point away from those two points is the sort of apex of the horseshoe. And that's where the central pragmatists sit. And you're not dogmatically ideological if it can be shown that the state is able to run a particular facility well.
Social grants for the very poor. I think these are things that liberal democracies all over the world acknowledge as being safety nets and blah, blah, blah. I mean, there are different positions.
These positions aren't fixed. In fact, we did a policy paper on energy. And one of the conclusions we reached, surprising for us, was that Eskom, if it is run as an energy company, and not as some adjunct to the National Democratic Revolution with political aims, even in the hands of the state, might be the best model to supply energy to a market as small as South Africa. Now, we'll reach that conclusion because it made sense and it's sensible. Mm-hmm. Our inclinations privatize everything, but in this particular case, we could see the merits of Eskom. If it is run as it was run from the early 1930s, when it was established as an energy company, not as a sort of political organisation, then if that was the case, obviously you have to take it out of the state's hands. So this, we're not dogmatic; we're pragmatic in the middle, and held up in social media and a lot of the media as that being exceptionally right wing, and that's. Well, that's obviously not the case at all.
Well, I agree with you about the horseshoe analogy, and I think that that's a much more sensible way to look at things. If it were linear, it would be, for some people's purposes, it positions them furthest from each other. And in fact, the minute you get to anyone who's autocratic, you end up either right or left. Yeah. You can never be a centrist. But if you're right or left, you're by definition going to end up autocratic because your ideology determines the outcome of everything. And you try to find equity rather than equality.
So the fault lines, I think, to split left from right, or rather than right, to use sort of the pragmatic center, are the following. Do you believe that market should play the predominant role in directing economic activity, or should the state decide how the economy should function? That's the one fault line. The second is property rights. Do you believe that if someone takes a risk and establishes an independent radio station, and that's very successful, that he's entitled to benefit completely from the effort and risk and so on that he took? Or do you believe it's now fundamentally unfair that he has a big successful radio station and everyone should be equal, so he must give a piece of that to someone else?
Let's just get into this for a second, because I think you're one of the few people I can have this conversation with where neither of us will become emotional. I think the basic motivation for being a leftist is probably a good one. It probably comes from altruism deep down. It comes from the idea that we should all be equal, that we should all have equal opportunity, that we should care for the poor, that we should support victims, we should support those who are too weak to defend themselves. That might be the very basic motivation that makes someone decide at a certain point in their life that they prefer what the left is saying to perhaps what the right or the center are saying. Compassion, right? It gets a little complicated when it starts being turned into policy, because it's usually hijacked by things that are not very rational.
I think it's a myth that compassion exists on the one side or the other. Whether compassion is really at play should be judged by the evidence. What characterized the 20 most successful economies of the last 100 years and what characterized the 20 most awful places to live in the last 100 years. There is no debate.
Yeah.
Societies that were free, that allowed their people to accumulate wealth, that protected property rights, that allowed markets to direct economic activity, delivered a vastly higher standard of living than societies in which leftist principles were at play. At best, therefore, you can get away with saying that some of the blind followers of leftist ideology are extremely badly educated and very naive. But when it comes to the leaders, political or in advocacy organizations or in the media of leftist causes, I don't think for a moment they can plead ignorance. I think there's something else to it. And like the inability of capitalists to defend their own interests, I don't know what it is. But the idea that it's naive altruism, okay, I've seen enough to know that's definitely not.
What do you suspect it is?
I don't know.
Can you begin to describe it?
It makes no sense. It makes no sense that an educated person who has had the opportunity to study Venezuela, Zimbabwe, East Germany, the Soviet Union, North Korea, the list goes on, can possibly suggest that
Cuba.
Our
whole country went crazy when Fidel Castro died, as if we'd lost someone who was a great asset to humanity.
You cannot study those societies, even the most cursory examination of them, and say that what happened there was substantively better than what happened in Western democracies. And Western democracies aren't perfect. But the poorest 10% of people that live in Western democracies are significantly better off than the richer 10%. What I think it is, you pushed me to say what I think it is. I think it's this. I think it's blind enslavement to ideology and theory. Where I've had these debates, which I avoid now because they're pointless, with people who hold these views, when you confront them with the actual evidence, they turn to theory, and they say, but in theory it should work.
Yeah,
and we'll do it differently.
Put into practice badly by those people, but yes, I'll be a better communist dictator.
We'll do it differently. We'll do it
right.
And they point to the flaws.
How many more people must die, and how many more people must starve for these ideologies to reach perfection?
And they point to the flaws in Western democracies, and they say that they're not perfect, and they're not perfect. And of course that's the case. And they're terribly poor people, and people have very unhappy lives. But on balance,
it's not a contest.
There is no contest here. On balance, a contest doesn't exist. It's the point that socialism is the equal sharing of misery and leftism, and that capitalism is the unequal distribution of wealth and happiness and prosperity. And those are the only choices. There is not a third way. A third way exists in sociology departments of universities, where they have departed so far from the real world the rest of us live in that they might as well be in a theoretical realm, a planet all on its own, with no relevance to the life experience of ordinary people.
Gwen and Gwenya has just joined you, and she's been on a couple of times with us. She's a very outspoken, very confident, very well-educated and well-rounded young lady. She's come up against a wave of ugly and nasty and ad hominem attacks on social media recently for her opinion about things that she's actually been intimately involved in, like the SRC of UCT. Have we forgotten the rules of engagement? Have we forgotten decorum in all of this? Or is that part of the arsenal that is deployed by these leftists?
Well, part of the sinister arsenal of the political left is, once they've lost the argument, that's not the end of it. Then there are slurs and innuendos and so on that are cast about the place. And in the example of this particular young woman, who will talk for herself and certainly doesn't agree with everything that I say, she took a very strong line, pointing out many of the problems and weaknesses with the fascist movement, at the University of Cape Town and began to attract some prominence and some media attraction for her views. And the next thing we know, I was away at the time, I get a phone call and journalists are asking whether she has a university degree, and she has several and much better ones than I have. And where this starts is leftist activists have gone onto social media to start a rumor that she lied about her qualifications. Other journalists have picked this up and are conducting interviews with her. And the kinds of stories that are being run, of course she has all degrees she claims she has, it couldn't be otherwise. The sort of story that gets run in the media is she's alleged not to have a degree. Then lots is written about Gladi Matsoneng, of all people, and this problem of people who don't have degrees. Then a little line that she actually proved that she has her degree, so everything's fine. And then a conclusion that we should watch very carefully for people that don't have degrees. The damage is done. The impression is created that she is a fraud, that she lies about her qualifications, she mustn't be taken seriously. It is a complete falsehood, actionable, and we brought on board attorneys to help us deal with it. But it is a typical case of where the nasty left, to distinguish them from the naive left, there's no third left, once you confront them with facts, with reasoned argument, they turn either to ideology, and when they're losing that fight,
characters,
very often it becomes a nasty type of slur campaign. And it is enabled by journalists and by media who are either willing to be used or are actually too ignorant to figure out that they are being used as pawns in a slur campaign which is directed at issues far deeper than whether a particular person has a university degree or not.
Have we lost, you mentioned UCT and the SRC there, have we lost the argument on campuses? Have campuses become nannies, mommy and daddies, for people who've been raised by bad mommies and daddies or not raised very well at all? And are these people looking for, you know, a home for stupid and bad ideas and for professors that will coddle these ideas? And professors who actually just want to be loved and popular themselves. What is going on campuses?
I think there are ironies on campuses. On the one hand, I think in South African case, politics and sociology departments have been teaching the Marxist dogma of revolution, which gave rise to the very, contributed to the very protests and destruction of property that reigned on campuses. And poor students must be terribly confused, because on the one hand, the university is egging this on, and when it happens, waving the police to shoot the students.
Yeah.
So there's a degree of that. But no, we haven't lost the battle on campuses at all. It may appear that if you look at how the violence and chaos and intimidation that plays itself out at places like the University of Cape Town. But I vouch this. If Max Price at the University of Cape Town allows an independent poll to be done of what the mass of the student body, past and present, wants for the university, and how it should deal with this phallus, violence and intimidation, I have no doubt you will find that the great majority of students, all races, creeds, colours, socioeconomic strata, will agree that the way the University of Cape Town is handling this issue is wrong. They want order brought back. They want people to be held culpable where they engage in violence. They want the intimidation to disappear off the campuses. And they want to be part of a successful, prosperous, well-regarded university. I don't think the leaders of the Fallist movement and the academics that enable them, including Max Price at Cape Town, have the courage to allow such an independent study to be done on their campuses, because the results will show that the majority view is very far off the impression that's been created in the media and social media yet again.
Now, since we're talking about him, you've invited a speaker to South Africa, someone who I think everybody's interested to hear from, not least of all because Max Price wouldn't have this particular individual on their campus. He was invited and then he was disinvited because some of his points of view may be offensive and maybe slightly contradictory to the views of some of these precious snowflake students who don't seem capable of entertaining two conflicting ideas in their heads at the same time.
Yeah, there's a man by the name of Fleming Rose, he's a writer of some prominence, and he has developed some controversial ideas over time, and he was invited to speak at the University of Cape Town.
What in particular about him offended them so much?
Well, I think, again, there's a lot of fabrication around Fleming Rose's actual views. But many of them, over a sustained period of time, have challenged traditional leftist or populist dogma on a range of issues, from religion to other matters. And he was invited and he accepted the invitation, and then from on high, the invitation was withdrawn. And it worried us a great deal, because if that was left to stand, what it would say is that there's no one left in South Africa who's willing to let a controversial character express his views in public. UCT also suggested that if he were allowed to come, there'd be a terrible violence and uprisings. It would just be dangerous to have him.
Mm.
And we've invited the man, and he'll be here later in the year, and he'll deliver a lecture. And the only point we want to make is a simple one. Not that we necessarily agree with his views or not. I'm still not sure whether I agree with his views. We want to make the point that it's possible to bring a controversial character to have a lecture in a civilized way. People listen to him, disagree with him, and he can get on his plane and he can fly back out of South Africa, and the sky hasn't fallen on our heads. Because the fear-mongering that UCT gave rise to, that if you let these controversial characters say what they think, the world will come to an end, is a grave threat to freedom of speech everywhere.
But we'll allow controversy on the other side to have its way with our academics and to flaunt its very suspicious agendas. Thomas Piketty was invited here. Nobody had a complaint about him.
Well, you should tolerate that. And that's, again, one of the fault lines. The pragmatic center will listen to all sides. It will engage with Piketty's views. I think he's completely wrong. I think he's done terrible damage to policy influences in South Africa. But of course you engage with him. You read his books. You study his arguments. You don't say you refuse to listen to the guy because you cannot. It would be dangerous to have.
No, I mean what's her name? Jenny McCarthy, who's this woman who she's an ex Baywatch star, and I think she was in Playboy or something. She says that vaccines lead to autism. And she has one or two wacky scientists who'll back her up on this. And it seems to have become a bit of a movement. A small movement, but it's a movement. Now, she's not a scientist. She doesn't have any credibility. But we allow her to say what she's going to say. And there probably will be some stupid people who won't vaccinate their children as a result of her crazy ideas. But she's tolerated. Similarly, Piketty and his like provide for people who have ideologically compromised positions to have some root of academia to support it. That doesn't mean that we should ban him outright. We should interrogate his ideas.
Yeah, we had the experience, I had it maybe 2 years back, when a relatively senior staffer and ideologically on the other side of the divide, an activist group, said that my group are given too many public platforms in South Africa. And that's fine. I mean, say that, it didn't have any consequence to the platforms we get. But we wrote to their chairman and said, this is incredibly dangerous because you are a following wind for the politicians and securocrats who want to shut down the democratic space in the country. And in time, this view that you are now associated with will be part of the momentum that will cut off the platforms to which you yourself have recourse. And let's think about the ground rules of this battle of ideas, that it's a mistake strategically for one side of the battle to say that the other side should not be heard, should not say, should not be allowed to, should not be listened to.
But try to go onto campus during one of these fallist demonstrations and try to espouse an opinion or a view contrary to theirs. You'll be lucky to get out without injury.
Yeah. And I think people that have tried to do that have said that they are afraid. It's a mad situation. I was invited recently to speak at one of these sort of book fair, festival type of things on a university campus. And last year that festival degenerated into chaos and what is in practice violence. And I actually said to the organizers, you know what, given the heavy schedule we have in any event and the fact that we're not going to make any money out of you to begin with, I just don't, it's not worth it to stand there for some idiot to jump on the stage and scream and shout and take their clothes off. And until your forum can actually show that you're able to provide a safe environment, I'm afraid we're not going to be able to help you out. And it's frightening. The organizer is a chap I know well and we spoke about, and it's frightening that we've got to that point. That book fairs, university campuses, are places where I would have concerns for the safety of my staff if they went to talk there and expressed their views. You just think that people like Max Price, and we speak a lot about him, but he's been prominent in this, sit back and think about what you've allowed to happen here, that we've got to that point. That is not right. And that it's been allowed to happen is something that bodes ill for free circulation of ideas in our society.
Can you imagine the pressure within academia even? If you were to publish a paper on something that perhaps would not go down with the current dominant political ideology, I wonder if you would retain your place in the profession. I wonder if you would be granted your degree. I wonder if there aren't people who would suppose it would be a better idea to keep you quiet.
Your experience obviously has been sufficient to get you very close to an important truth, that the threats to freedom of speech and ideas in South Africa is not the Ministry of Communications or the State Security Ministry.
No, they're too incompetent to do that.
Some of the greatest threats to freedom of speech are prominent editors and journalists, leaders of civil society, academics.
And let's not for a moment give them the credit of letting them think that they've made those decisions, that they've become part of that problem voluntarily. Very often it is fear, and it is cowardice.
Yeah, well, without knowing the individuals, it's of course hard to say what it is.
No,
maybe it's a desire to be on the right side.
Knowing some of these individuals, I can assure you it is due to a lack of courage.
But the point stands nonetheless that the cliche is to look at the Minister of State Security and some of his jammers in Parliament and so on. So that's a threat to freedom of speech.
No.
Not at all. That's not the threat. The threat is the creeping stranglehold of political correctness born of fear that means that the real discussions, the interesting ones, the bold ones about what's happening in South Africa, take place increasingly behind closed doors and rarely, and why I say you're worth as much as you're worth as a group like this, on platforms such as this one, the Renegade Report, and the handful full of independent media platforms that have the courage to put some of these ideas out. And if our polling's anything to go by, the demand for that is immense. And in time, hopefully, those platforms will be rewarded in viewers, in readers, in people. And it's not to agree with us. We're not worried if someone can come back after this radio program is broadcast and say to me, you were wrong on this point and I've developed a better idea. That's the point. We think we're right.
Then we all get smarter.
But let's, when we deal with each other, let's deal with each other in a manner that we make progress in developing new knowledge, effective policies, new ideas. Not get into something where slurs and innuendo and other forms of underhanded behavior take the place of fact-based, rational debate, policy making.
You've ended it better than I could have, so we'll stop there, and not just because I feel like it's the best way to end it, but also because we're out of time, and there's so many other things that we could talk to you about, and probably in future will, identity politics, the idea of multi-party democracy, and race relations themselves, which I think you did touch on in the beginning, but that it is your kind of overriding interest in the organization at the IRR to pursue. So I thank you for coming to spend some time with us this morning, Franz, and I do hope we'll get to see you again. This is just the tip of the iceberg, but thank you.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. CliffCentral.com.